Tuesday, the 4th of February, and here we are, all set for the third episode of our Introduction to Journalism Studies. Just a reminder, the register is out there somewhere. Who's actually got the register at present? Put your hand up. Register? I know it's something out there somewhere. Somebody got a register that's sort of sitting there? Anyway, make sure it's being passed along that you do actually sign it. And I want to start off with a little bit of interactivity, just a teeny bit of interactivity, not too much. But I'd like to ask the question, how many people here regularly read, and by regularly I mean actually take pretty much two out of every three issues of a magazine? That can be anything from Cosmopolitan to Red through to 442, Empire, Time, New Statesman. Put your hands up, basically, if you read a magazine regularly. Yeah, okay, fine, it's all right, hands down. Interesting, because that question, which I kind of ask on an annual basis, have done for the last sort of few years, consistently we're seeing a reduction in the number of hands going up from that point of view. Because you could actually argue that this lecture could maybe be subtitled The Fall of the Magazine Market. It's gone from a period of extreme influence, and probably still is, but it's less impactful, certainly in terms of the Generation X's and so on, than perhaps it used to be. And the reason I've entitled this one Hearth and Home is it kind of really epitomises 150 years or so of history, from the back end of the 19th century to the early part of the 21st century, in which actually the way in which the public would consume magazines or comic books or issues relating to that whole thing was big business. It was probably in many ways the opportunity that journalists actually had to make more sense of the world, to actually have longer, more fulsome pieces. Anybody who's actually seen A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood starring Tom Hanks will be aware that that was actually based on an article that was written for Esquire magazine in the 1990s about a children's entertainer. And again, it opens up a whole range of aspects in terms of deep focus studies and so on, which is still out there and still actually being used, but maybe, just maybe, it's not getting the kind of numbers and the kind of traction it once had, for reasons that probably relate to the internet, relate to new technologies, and so on. But that's something, again, we can discuss in seminars and so forth. So, in terms of actually organising this whole sequence, well, magazine journalism in itself has been a neglected area of academic study. Press historians such as Curran and Seaton, who produced the classic Power Without Responsibility, tend to have very little to say about magazine journalism. And yet, if you were to look at the media job adverts in any of the pages of the quality recruitment organisations, The Guardian, The Independent and so on, you would see that basically magazines were, and still arguably are, major employers of journalists. And that line about the online notion of magazines, that many magazines, their online versions, aren't too dissimilar from their physical paper versions, including even having the sort of facility to flip over pages and various other factors. Certainly, one undeniable fact remains that the magazine market has been a significant employer of journalists throughout the 20th century and indeed the early part of the 21st century. And what I'm going to do today is concentrate particularly on the nature of the magazine market in the first 50 years of its existence. So, kind of as I said, from the late 1890s through to the 1930s, 1940s. A very critical year, not only because we went through two world wars, but also in terms of the changes and impacts that people had in terms of their leisure time and so on. And again, looking ahead briefly to next week when I talk about how the BBC impacted, again, some of the ways in which, from the studies of journalism, things open up into a whole new area. Why was there such a demand for reading material? How did it develop? How did the titles and contents of the magazines that were being provided actually alter to affect the changing nature of the marketplace they were working in? and also the ones in which they had to compete. Even now, you can go into most supermarkets, obviously Aldi stopped carrying a magazine rack, but most supermarkets, news agents and so on, certainly WH Smith, there's a substantial area of floor space given to a vast array of magazines from a vast array of topics, from the general to the specific and so on. There were also two particular sectors of magazines that grew substantially. Children's magazines, or comic books, and women's magazines. And again, we can sort of see the manifestation in terms of the huge success of the Marvel Universe films, etc., in terms of how that sort of crosses over in terms of multimedia storytelling and so on. And that is something else to take away from today. It's the narrative, the story, the cliffhanger ending. Back in the day, Charles Dickens and contemporary writers, Arthur Conan Doyle, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and so on, they were writing serials. They were writing magazines, they were writing stories for magazines which would have cliffhanger endings. It was a strategy that was being used, and again, is still used in terms of the way in which people want you to keep coming back, whether you're actually looking at online media or indeed other sort of areas. It's following that cash mandate. Certainly, the importance of women's magazines, at least from the 1920s until the 1940s, 50s, was quite phenomenal. And also the way in which children's magazines were actually being used and developed as well. The publishing phenomenon, which one of you may have a dim and distant recollection of, called FHM magazine, which was very much targeted at young men, had an average sale at the start of this century, February 2000, of a little under 750,000 copies per month. To be precise, 702,514 copies were shifted of FHM magazine, etc. And again, when you actually see that alongside sales of IPC's Woman magazine, Woman's Own, Woman's Weekly, each one of those had weekly sales that was in excess of 500,000. So lots of key things working through that. One of the areas I'm going to be looking at in terms of general magazines and comic magazines, of course, is the publishing house responsible for The People's Friend and The Beano and The Dandy and various other newspapers, etc., DC Thompson, based, of course, in Dundee. And there's a lot of, again, magazine areas that are coming through, all to provide entertainment, to provide a way in which people would actually work through their own particular beliefs, etc. There. In case you were wondering what was FHM magazine, was the lead story of this particular aspect there from that point of view. Okay, so let's go back to that whole notion in terms of how did this market get created in the first place? How was it developed? How did we actually see the phenomenon of all these magazines looking at the sort of things? I mean, again, look on the first floor, look at the journalism rack. We've got the LSJ magazine. You know, magazines are still a critical part of our everyday experience in terms of ways in which things are being targeted for us, etc. Ways of providing gossip, ways of actually providing us with information, ways of providing us with self-improvement aspects. All of these key things are there. And some may actually say it was the extension of literacy through the Education Acts of 1870, 1880, and 1891 that actually prompted the development of a marketplace which provided light reading. Magazines could actually satisfy that quite easily. Also, bear in mind that little headline there, that improve your brain power in just 5 simple steps. All part and parcel of how we're seeing magazines as targeting people to improve ourselves and so on. Now, contemporary critics in the 19th century often blamed the Education Act of 1870 for bringing bad taste to the masses. The rationale for the Education Act was to bring elementary education within the reach of every child. Again, literacy was not something which immediately occurs overnight. Something is permeated through the culture and so on. However, critics would actually say that this developed bad reading tastes. One of those critics, as you can see on screen there, was Joseph Ackland. In his paper, Elementary Education and the Decay of Literature, He talks about the intellectual faculties of the bulk of the nation being too long held in bondage. And he specifically says, it shall not cause any wonder that when the shackles of ignorance were struck off, there was a rush to the fields of fancy and pleasure. His argument there is not that basically people shouldn't read, but they should read worthwhile texts. They shouldn't read trivia. They shouldn't read gossip. They shouldn't read quick, easy stories filling their mind with nonsense. They should have a focus. We're seeing the beginnings here of something which echoed throughout the 20th century and still does, in many ways, this whole notion of a high and low culture. That there are certain things which are deemed to be important and special and worthwhile studying, and others which are basically, literally, tomorrow's trash. In his novel New Grub Street, George Gissing talked about the publishing world. He satirised the publishing world. And he suggested that the publishing industry in the 1890s, at the end of the 19th century, was creating titles that was primarily catering for a vast readership whom Gissing described as being one quarter educated. The novel New Grub Street actually refers to a fictional magazine which he actually called Chit Chat. This, Gissing explained, was aimed at the young men and women who could just about read, but had the attention spans of goldfish. They couldn't concentrate. There were all sorts of other things happening. It's kind of like a 19th century version of somebody who's obsessed with social media, maybe. But again, this whole notion of how you're relating to attention and spans on that basis as well. Now, one of the key things about Chit Chat was that it addressed this whole notion of critically discussing the whole magazine industry. It actually sounds like a thinly disguised version of a magazine that still kind of emerges, although for slightly different reasons, a magazine that was entitled Titbits. Titbits was first published in 1881, again satirised by George Gissing in New Grub Street. And primarily, the mission statement of Titbits was, as you can see on screen there, to be a snippet newspaper. A newspaper which actually didn't cover any stories in detail. A magazine that basically would select from various other key things what was being developed. And the editor described Titbits' intentions with the statement you can see on screen there. With, of course, that wonderful guarantee. Again, we'll come back to this later. The magazine's guarantee that you will improve as a person if you will only buy this magazine, because you'll be able to drop in all manner of witticisms and creative statements. You can, when stuck for conversation, perhaps throw in a few little asides along the lines of, did you realise that the nearest British relation to the Indonesian parrot is indeed the cuckoo? It's a freebie for you. I mean, it is. Nearest British relation to the Indonesian parrot, the cuckoo. Either way, you're basically encouraging your readership to be part of your particular group, part of your gang, part of your development. Now, Titbits, on the one hand, was praised as a unique path towards edifying the masses, to providing them with a lot of things that they could actually do. In those journeys that many people were occupying themselves with in commuting. Because clearly by the end of the 19th century and in the beginning of the 20th century, we're seeing people using mass transit, travelling to work. There's no surprise that the majority of W.H. Smith's news agents were located near railway stations. It's where people would go to effectively, obviously, pick up either a newspaper or magazine or something which effectively could past the dreary hours as they commuted from wherever to London or wherever and so on. And the range of magazines was huge. Titbits was praised as a path towards edifying the masses, but it was also criticised as somehow symbolising the decline of British journalism. It was dealing with trivia. It wasn't dealing with focus stories and so on. However, by 1888, Titbits was selling an average of 350,000 copies a week. Inevitably, rival publishers noted the success of the title and they sought to emulate, Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. They sought to actually produce alternative titles, like the Strand magazine, probably most celebrated for launching Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes upon the world in serialised form, like the Wide World magazine and so on. All of these would basically sort of join the whole system and they're produced by Northcliffe Press, which also produced Pearson's Weekly, as similar types of magazine. They'd actually have answers to correspondence. That's the kind of figures that we're actually reaching at by the end of the start of the 20th century and, of course, the start of the Great War in 1914. 50,000 different periodicals, over 200 publishers producing those 50,000 things of weekly and monthly periodicals in Britain. Now, there was great competition between these rival magazines, between these rival publishing houses and so on. There were strategies that were being used to effectively open up the discussions. In answers to correspondence, Harmsworth Press offered up a scheme which you might view with a certain notion of, well, that's quite macabre or bizarre, because they actually offered an insurance scheme to its readers. And the scheme went as follows. This is the fine print. If a reader was injured in a railway accident while carrying a copy of the magazine Answers to Correspondence, then that victim would be paid £1,000. Wow. It's almost an incentive to carry the magazine and then actually step onto a railway track and get knocked over just as a result of that. During a flu epidemic, Pearson's Weekly actually sprayed its magazine with eucalyptus oil as a preventative. You know, on the grounds of if you read the magazine, obviously you get newsprint and eucalyptus oil and it'll stop you from catching cold and so on. So lots of, again, strange ideas. These are precursors to what you now see as the free gifts. Back in the 1990s, as opposed to the 1890s, simply putting a CD or a silvery disc or DVD on the front cover of your magazine instantly shot up its sales. And I suspect, and we'll talk about this in seminars, but I suspect every one of you at one stage as a child has possibly been attracted to the free gift that's actually been stuck on a comic magazine or various other things, whatever that happens to be. So again, strategies that are being used to actually encourage regular purchasing of magazines, etc., all slotted into place within that. Prior to the First World War, the majority of children's magazines were targeted at boys. The majority actually had titles such as Boys' Own Papers, Young England, Chums, as you can see on screen there, and The Captain. Now, these titles were all very middle class in orientation, and they were aimed primarily at boys who were between 10 and 15 years of age. So you're looking at adolescent young teenagers at this stage, although the teenager as a phenomenon wasn't introduced until the 1950s as an American kind of import. So again, it's a case of you go to school, you leave school at 14, you're off to work, etc. So you've got an interest in that. Unless, of course, you are in the middle class environment and you're probably going to school, grammar school, and then university, and so on. What all of these magazines had in common was that they celebrated the public schools. They ran articles on the history of the public schools, the customs that the public schools brought to bear, public school spirit. And they certainly pursued the cult of athleticism that was all present within the public school environment. It's often said that the playing fields of England and rugby and so on that led to the success in the First World War and so on. Well, again, that's another interesting aspect to debate and so on. And those of you who've seen 1917 will possibly have something to say in terms of the reality of the whole system or aspects relating to that. But that whole sense of celebrating the amateur, somehow actually getting paid for being a sportsman, was dirty. It was unclean. You shouldn't be professional. It's one of the reasons why rugby union for such a long time maintained its code of being strictly amateur in terms of its whole sequence. Athletics, likewise. You didn't want to have that classic disconnect and the whole time of football being a game for gentlemen played by ruffians and rugby being a game for ruffians played by gentlemen kind of begins to emerge at this time and so on. Magazines such as Chums would often contain detailed information about sporting techniques, especially regarding cricket and athletics. Up until the second half of the 20th century, there was actually very little reading material available for the budding sportsman, and even less about technique, how to actually improve your particular abilities, etc. So a keen youngster would therefore seek out articles in magazines. And the major component, of course, of the pre-war boys' magazines were the tales of derring do, perfected by writers such as G.A. Henty, and the lines of the sort of experience of doing it for the cause, old chap, and working through that process. Now, was this a kind of ideological brainwashing? Some people think it was, some people think it wasn't. Again, that's open for debate and discussion and so on. Chums set its stories on the frontiers of the empire. Britain, of course, at this stage, pretty much ran a third of the globe. A third of the world was pretty much under the administration of the British Empire. And so stories that took part on the frontiers of the empire, which would take a strong pro-British Empire stand, would exemplify and stress the virtues of British pluck. Middle-class manliness was defined on the pages of these magazines in terms of tenacity, in terms of daring, in terms of moral decisiveness. All the kind of things we kind of expect from our current Prime Minister, really. Or maybe not. The language of good behaviour was borrowed from the sports field, playing the game, having the right approach of things, and so on and so forth. All of these certainly added to the sense of producing a whole literate class who were focusing on the essence of what it was to be British, creating our national identity, working through that process. Certainly in their relationships to the lower classes, quality magazines and comics like The Captain and Chums would be quite explicit in how they were presenting their opinions. As I said, they regretted professionalism in sport. They celebrated the tall, clean-limbed, athletic amateur. You know, the amateur was somehow tied in with the ancient Greek notion of, you know, this is why we do it. Certainly above the bullet-headed, bull-necked professional. Robert MacDonald's quote there, again, is quite an interesting line in terms of where we're seeing this aspect coming across. What sort of messages are going out, again, throughout all levels of society? Idealism married to innocence. A generation of officers going to the trenches knowing that playing the game was the true mark of chivalry. Again, interesting line from that particular perspective, which again we'll come on to talk about later. And obviously there we have the whole sort of system. You know, £4,000 you could actually win in this particular edition of Union Jack, the special Christmas number and so on. Now the writers who would be employed on such magazines and comics clearly felt that they were charged with a most responsible task. They needed to train the future generation of citizens. They needed to address some of the central issues of the day, issues relating to the nature of morality. What is the right thing to do? We talk about doing the right thing. What is the right thing to do? How do you avoid decadence? How do you actually maintain patriotism? How do you actually sort of fulfill the duty of patriotism? And after the First World War, obviously known as the Great War, because we all know World War II was going to happen, the children's magazine market continued to expand and more titles began to appear. Titles such as School Friend, Schoolgirl's Own, Schoolgirls Weekly, and Crystal, and so on. So you're seeing, again, an expansion of markets, and, of course, some magazines you may even be familiar with today, although the Dandy ceased its publication as a full magazine and went online a few years ago. The Beano still obviously thrives from that point of view. Most of the comic magazines in the 20s and 30s were owned by the Dundee publisher D.C. Thompson. The big five were Adventure, The Rover, The Wizard, The Skipper, and The Hotspur. And according to Ross McKibben, a majority of boys of all ages and in all kinds of schools read comics in the 20s and 30s. Wizard alone was read by over half of all grammar school boys, and two-thirds of senior school boys as well. quarter of the time girls spent reading magazines was also devoted to boys' comics, despite the fact that although girls were reading boys' comics, there were no real concessions made to female readers at the time. Many children would read more than one magazine. In a 1930s London survey, over 50% would read three or more magazines a week, and of that number, 30% would read six or more. So a lot of comic book reading going on, a lot of swapping in the playground, etc. Lots of multiple reading possible due to swapping arrangements which would help embed magazine culture in the playground. The circulation of children's magazines, a little erratic during the interwar period. Between the 1920s and 1930s, there was a slow decline, partly due to the competition of the other mass media that was evolving, a thing called radio. And sales improved significantly during the war, as they did, of course, with all forms of literature. It was during the 1950s, however, that the traditional magazines suffered first from the success of The Eagle, published by Hilton Press, and also the onslaught of the American magazine market and so on. Again, you can see in terms of the aspects there, taken from a Hotspur magazine, the line that Alf Tupper, tough of the track, effectively the success, the way in which ideologies are put together. There's a Romeo magazine there with The Price of Love and so on. And then this emergence by an English vicar in the 1950s who basically wanted to again restore the notion of Britishness post-World War II. And developed this from Hulton Press. The Eagle was a pictorial comic. It was based on the American model. Now, comic books had kind of been around in the States since pretty much the start of the 20th century. And certainly writers such as Alex Raymond, who produced Flash Gordon, and Moulton, who produced Buck Rogers in the 21st century, would have their comic strips developed. But arguably the first major shift, if you exclude some of the pulp fiction writers such as Lester Dent and Robert E. Howard, from the point of view of Doc Savage and Conan the Barbarian and other areas, was probably down to Simon Schuster, Joe Schuster, and Jerry Siegel, the creators of a character called Superman, which after several failed attempts effectively launched in Action Comics number 1 in 1938. Looking quite good for an 80-year-old, over 80-year-old, followed rapidly by Batman and a whole range of other characters that were used very much as a kind of easy way of entertaining the troops, entertaining the masses, entertaining the children, also producing very solid propagandist messages and issues as well. And in the aftermath of World War II, there was the sense that actually we needed some kind of British response to that. Sales of the Eagle were in excess of 1 million per week from its original founding days in 1950. Although, again, from the late 50s onwards, children's television or children's magazines and children's comics also tended to be impacted by the growth of that other mass medium, television. Although many magazines would then actually sort of start adopting television and use that and incorporating stories within the magazines, etc. So what do these magazines and comics contain? Well, pretty much they were school-based stories. They actually focused on a whole range of issues relating to school, etc. Magnet comic would bring Billy Bunter to the world. Magazines such as Wizard had six or seven different kinds of a story. They had a school story. They had a joke page. They had a competition praise with prizes. All of them tried to obtain their readers by featuring a regular character. You had characters like the detective adventurer Dixon Hawke in Adventure, or the Wolf of Kabul in The Wizard. And the editors would also adopt a fairly intimate relationship to their readers. You can see a kind of echo of this if we have any 2000 AD readers these days, with Tharg and Splendid Verthrig and his relation to Earthlets and so on. There's a kind of editorial which kind of identifies the relationship between the creators, the editors, and the readership, etc. Arguably, that's one of the other aspects about editorials in magazines. There is that personalised relationship that you occasionally get in newspapers, but maybe not to the extent that you get in magazines and so on. The opening lines from The Wizard, actually, were a page which was entitled "Step Right Up and Have a Chat with Your Editor," and the following page included the lines, "My dear chum, see the heading? That's the spirit. No hanky-panky. Get right down to bedrock and have a chat. You and I like two pals." So again, it's looking at very much developing that whole sequence. Boys' magazines also became the subject of a celebrated attack by the writer George Orwell in 1940. Orwell actually wrote that their political assumptions were twofold. One, nothing ever changes. And two, foreigners were fun. Their mental world, according to Orwell, was stuck in 1914 or pre-1914. There was no slump, there was no unemployment, there were no trade unions, there were no strikes, there was certainly no fascism. The working class would be absent except as comic figures or villains, and the magazines would be full of racial stereotypes. Most whites were good, except obviously the Germans. Blacks and Chinese would be the subject of intense ridicule, and indeed the evil Chaz Feng, a villain from China, was fond of saying the white race will one day learn the power of the yellow peril. Jew, the black giant of Nigeria, would go on berserk, terrorise rampages through Bedford and Leighton Buzzard. So lots of issues with respect to that in terms of what were they thinking and so on. It's difficult to disagree with Orwell's attack on such magazines, but it's also difficult to measure the impact of such reading materials on impressionable minds. There's one phenomenon that kind of addresses this issue in a way that suggests, well, if all of these children's comics and boys' comics, etc., had been so successful in brainwashing or in indoctrinating or in following and driving a particular ideology, why was it that the majority of those people who voted for the first time in 1945 resulted in a huge majority for a Labour government? Again, that didn't necessarily imply a serious departure from the whole notion, but it was an interesting point. You would have possibly said, if everybody had followed that path, well, you would have re-elected Churchill because it would have been the patriotic duty to do so. That lack of resentment by the bulk of the electorate and the image of the public school might also kind of relate to the whole notion of the fantasies of school within the popular boys' magazines. Comic magazines would be the staple of the children's magazine market, certainly for the first 50 years of the 20th century, and arguably up to the 80s and 90s as well, from that point of view. Although there were also more specialised magazines which were targeted at boys related to, as I mentioned, particular sports and hobbies. Including what some people might now consider the rather unfortunately titled The Boy Fancier, which was, of course, a magazine for young pigeon enthusiasts. Let's look now at D.C. Thompson in a little bit more detail. Who oversaw the writing process for these children's magazines and so on? Who was actually developing the whole package of where we were going before we head into women's magazines and The Lady and so on? Well, D.C. Thompson, as I mentioned, produced The Wizard, Hotspur, Beano and so on, and the editing staff at D.C. Thompson were all well-treated. They were also closely involved in the management of the business. The company was non-unionised, and it's interesting, anybody here has got any employment with Amazon or connection with Amazon? Amazon actually run a 30-minute training video for all staff, which actually encourages people, if they suspect anybody who tried to set a union, of basically reporting it immediately. It's quite interesting in all sorts of ways. Another sort of issue for another time, perhaps. The company, as I say, was non-unionised, but morale at D.C. Thompson was high. There was a paternalistic nature of the firm, which guaranteed good wages and job security, at least if you're based in Dundee. If a title failed, you wouldn't be sacked. You'd simply move the editorial team and transfer them onto other duties. Some of the Thompson editors actually worked for the company for over 50 years. However, the company's employees, if you were a journalist who wanted to work for D.C. Thompson, you would be carefully screened. You'd be screened to ensure that you were the right sort of person. Early psychometrics, which again, we kind of take for granted at present. You would need to be compatible with the firm. You need to be compatible with the high moral policies of the firm. And each applicant for a job at D.C. Thompson had to sit a test paper. And as one of its editors actually noted, the aim of the test paper was to try to find out which way your mind worked, which way your brain thought or your thoughts tended. On that, and a general understanding about general knowledge in the world about you, you either got a position or you didn't. The relationship between the writer and editor at D.C. Thompson was also very close. This is something that, again, was echoed by Stan Lee, Jack Kirby and other writers within the early or the years of the Marvel method of the 1960s and 70s and so on. So that stories would be written to the firm's exact specifications. All of the writers were freelance, none was kept on the staff, and writers were visited by senior editors who provided them with a roster of story ideas for 6 months of work. Now, the actual amount of stuff that was being produced is phenomenal. Some of the figures here, you need to almost take a step back in terms of when you think, oh, really? Freelance writer claimed to have written 8 million, million words of fiction during his 8 years of work there. So that's 1 million words per year. Many of Thompson's writers would be switched from writing for the company's children's magazines to producing work for popular women's magazines, such as, of course, the classic The People's Friend. Which brings us neatly to the women's magazine market and how this also developed within the whole sequence. And if we take a similar pattern through from this late 19th century edition of The Lady, still in publication these days, if you wish to actually advertise for the right sort of staff or got a flavour in terms of the right appropriate etiquettes to actually employ, etc., etc., it's still around. A whole range of specialist women's magazines began to appear in the late 19th century and the early 1900s, so the early 20th century, catering for the sporting interests of ladies of leisure. Ladies who would be middle to upper middle class, who effectively had time on their hands because they had the right staff, but even then there's a way in which that can be addressed, as I'll demonstrate in a few moments. So titles such as The Lady Cyclist of 1895, The Wheel Woman of 1897, The Hockey Field of 1910, Ladies Golf of 1912, and The Golfing Gentlewoman of 1914 would all be targeting women who were interested in sport, up to fashion, but their own kind of sport, their own kind of aspects as well. The two cycling magazines would carry advice, news, information, and interviews. All of those things were designed explicitly to instruct the women of England in the art and pastime of cycling, and to be a medium of intercommunication between women who cycle. So it's a great social event as well. It's important to obviously cycle on that basis. It's also a kind of early, arguable sort of notion of, again, the sort of emancipation which kind of grew with the pace with the need in the First World War and then sort of postscript and the growth of the suffragette movement and so on, which I don't want to gloss over too much at this particular time, but we will return to in later areas. Women's magazines expanded phenomenally in the interwar period, just as children's comics had. There were 60 new women's magazines launched between 1920 and 1945. Many of them had a domestic bias. They had a whole range of titles such as My Little Home, Mother, Woman and Home, and Good Housekeeping. Again, I think we can kind of see the ideological message that's kind of coming through within this particular area. At the top end of the women's magazine market, you had titles such as the aforementioned The Lady and The Queen. And they would cater for the aristocracy, they'd cater for the gentry. But they'd also be read by the socially ambitious, another key point of magazines. You read a magazine to find out how do you actually improve your lot in life. What sort of things do you want to do? Do you want to improve your sporting techniques? Do you want to improve your cycling skills? Do you want to improve the way to behave and so on and so forth? All the way back to that quote we looked at from Tidbits magazine in terms of how is it kind of being promoted to you as a way of improving, as a way of self-improvement. And nobody's going to read the magazine for you, I suppose, but normally that's a one-to-one direct community and connection link. Vogue also launched a whole new fashion magazine market. And there was also, in addition to that, a whole new range of magazines aimed at the affluent middle class. There were quite expensive monthlies, such as Good Housekeeping, as you can see there, launched in 1922, Women and Home in 1926, My Home and Modern Home in 1928. And that whole notion of progressivism, things improving, more technology, roaring 20s, people having other sort of offers of work, people not having to actually go into domestic service, people having a choice, all led to the whole notion of, well, how do you actually maintain standards when you can't run a home without getting the right servants? Emphasis of those titles was therefore on informing middle-class women in particular how to run a home in a changing society when their servants were becoming more scarce. But domestic technology was becoming more important. Now, in her recent article, the writer, Catherine Horwood. Yeah. Catherine Horwood took a close look at Good Housekeeping magazine. Good Housekeeping magazine was an American magazine which launched its own British version in March 1922. Ironically, the same year that the British Broadcasting Company also started, so significant from that point of view. Women's magazines had also been seen as playing a crucial role in the advancement of the cult of domesticity. The cult of domesticity. Many women's magazines tried to indeed elevate the image of women as homekeepers, homemakers, by attempting to dignify what could otherwise be seen as drudgery. Again, from a fairly contemporary sort of issue, this particular thing, February 2002, some of the other sort of aspects, you're still looking at the same kind of style, the same sort of aspects that are there, having a happy ever, etc., etc., etc. From the 1920s onwards, as the standards of living of many middle-class families rose, servants became more difficult to hire, owing to more attractive alternative forms of employment, there was clearly a market for magazines which were going to provide helpful tips in terms of how to run your home. And this is where Good Housekeeping also capitalised very solidly, because they introduced the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. That whole notion of any particular technology, be it a vacuum cleaner, be it a newfangled refrigerator, be it a whatever, white goods as we refer to it now, which advertised in Good Housekeeping, would be given the whole notion of a refund guarantee, which meant that if you purchased your magazine or purchased your goods through the Good Housekeeping magazine, you had that Good Housekeeping seal of approval, and therefore you're more likely to buy the magazine because it's more attractive to you, because you can buy things from that magazine which will be guaranteed, and so on and so forth. So it's a wonderful way in which these things are kind of working together in an era which, throughout journalistic history, ever since the first broadsides were being produced in the 1700s, it's selling advertising. It's getting into that whole notion of delivering audiences to advertisers because you've got that need to sell things, to buy additional product, etc. Which magazine is probably the most famous example of consumer-based, consumer-led scenarios from that point of view. An advert in 1923 stated that the Hoover was no longer a luxury. It is today a necessity, so went the advertisement. It frees you and your servants forever from the tyranny of the broom. The tyranny of the broom, because you've got the Hoover. And as the 1920s progressed, there was a gradual shift as more and more adverts would actually portray the housewife using the vacuum cleaner or polishing furniture, looking as though she's having the best experience ever. Absolutely fantastic. Gets back to that whole issue of what we're seeing, how we're seeing things developed, and so on. I want to return in the concluding sections to the lower middle class market, the lower middle class female market. Now, there were titles that were launched such as Woman's Own in 1932 and Woman itself, or just Woman, in 1937, which didn't quite have that Good Housekeeping seal of approval. But they still had huge success within their targeted audience. They weren't filled with adverts for new domestic technology, but their stated aim, again, as stated in their editorials, was to enhance the domestic capabilities of their readership. Enhance the domestic capabilities of their readership. Woman's Own actually launched itself in 1932 with the following editorial. How do you do? We introduce ourselves and our new weekly for the modern young wife who loves her home. Woman's Own will be a paper with a purpose, a paper thoroughly alive to the altered conditions of the present day. The home paper that makes any girl worth her salt wants to be the best housewife ever, and then some. Now, you could actually argue that with that, added to a first issue which came with a free gift of wool, you've set the pattern for all subsequent issues. It also contained the first episode of a romantic serial. Features included the right sort of frocks to wear. So you have this interconnectivity between obviously the magazine and the audience. Is it something where basically academics turn around and say, oh, it's far too much paid with respect to that, far too much detail in terms of what we're looking at, in terms of the ideology and so on and so forth? Or is it in many ways something which kind of goes back to the notion of what messages are being put out in terms of the kind of things that are going out there? Or is it simply reflecting society? Should you actually choose to do the essay, well, we release them in terms of the whole thing of this. We talk about strategies for magazines and strategies that are being employed for both children's magazines and women's magazines. But I'll leave you with this thought in terms of how things overall developed. America had a much more developed and focused men's magazine market from pretty much the whole of the 20th century. Hugh Hefner's philosophy on sexuality and Playboy, etc., certainly emerged and lasted for considerable decades and so on. In Britain, as I say, it kind of took time, but when FHM finally actually launched and then leading to its other sort of spin-offs, etc., things like Maxim, Zoo, Nuts, and various other sort of slightly unsavoury sort of aspects, there were other issues at work there. But are magazines still as important in terms of forming opinions? Do you, again, access the whole thing from the point of view of the Spectator, the New Statesman, views on that, Private Eye, all those kind of things? Or is it an area that you think, actually, it's all online now? In which case, how do you then address the question of many magazines who do go online and effectively simply replicate their product online in, as I say, a virtual world? Things to consider, things to talk about. Thanks for your time, thanks for listening today. And next week, we will be on to the BBC.